Welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. I'm Chris Sissons, and my business is Market Together. I'm a local marketing coach who specializes in storytelling for business development and marketing. On this show, we talk about everything storytelling. And here is my co-host.
Hi, I'm Gemma Rosenthal, and my business is Creative Hearts. I'm a singer-songwriter, dancer, actor, and I help you to find your voice and live your most creative life. On today's show, we'll talk about Zen, drugs, rock and roll, whether it's better off to be hopeless or hopeful, and prompts to help us find stories we never knew we had.
And this time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Sarah J. Hawley. Sarah J's diverse career as a music practitioner spans over 30 years. Sarah has written and performed and recorded in many styles and for other artists and toured extensively, including headlining Glastonbury's Pyramid Stage with Massive Attack. Her voice and songs have been heard by millions, notably on Massive Attack's platinum-selling album Mezzanine. Her collaboration, Dissolved Girl, woke Neo at the beginning of The Matrix, and then it was remixed for the hit TV show Westworld. Her gig theatre show Zen, Drugs and Rock and Roll recently sold out the Crucible Theatre Sheffield and will be touring next year. She's taught vocals, performance skills and songwriting for over 20 years and is also a qualified yoga teacher. Welcome to Find, Tell, Share, Sarah.
Woo! Hey, guys. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for being on the podcast.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant biography. I don't really know where to begin. Well, I do know where to begin. you live in Sheffield, Sarah.
I do, yes. Yeah. I live in Sheffield, around Encliffe Park, Hunters Bar.
Oh, that's where I was brought up. Were you born in Sheffield, nice. Or are you?
No, it's a long tale. I grew up in Skegness.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right. That's where Sheffielders used to go to go on holiday.
It is indeed. I think that's why we ended up there. My granddad was a Derbyshire miner, and my mum and when they were kids used to go on holiday to Skegness. And yeah, she just ended up going back there to live. When she grew up.
Mm. So you'll be an aficionado of fish and chips, rock and candy floss.
Yes.
That should have been the title. That's another one. Yeah, next.
And I bet you know how to spare seagulls.
Yes. How to what, Chris?
How to scare seagulls. If you're eating your fish and chips and...
I know,
But so what brought you to Sheffield and why are you staying here?
I came to go to art college in the 80s. I went to Salter Lane Art College to do a communication arts degree, and mainly because it had a music studio. And that was one of the biggest pulls for me at the time. Apart from the fact, you know, I'd come from a very small town and... I was carrying a lot of baggage around with me at the time, and it was a hop, skip and jump. I went to Lincoln Art College to do a foundation degree, and then Sheffield was the next pit stop on the old Viking Way, which was the... Skegness is Viking for nose of the sea, and it was one of the first places the Vikings landed all those years ago, and they made their way inland, and there's the A1 really is the old Viking Way, and it went from Skegness straight up to Lincoln, and then continued to find a hill so that they could create battlements. And I love a bit of history. And also being an old Viking myself, very interested in this stuff. So Lincoln Art College, Sheffield was the natural next stop for me. And the pull, obviously, because my family were all from Derbyshire. And it was nice because to me, my granddad really had the broadest Derbyshire accent. I couldn't understand a word he said. So it was nice to kind of settle here for a bit and work out what the hell he was on about.
So you say you're a Viking.
Yes.
Does that mean that your family's matrilineal?
I don't know what that means.
The mother's surname gets passed down instead of the father's surname.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. But when I was in my early 20s, I changed my last name to my mum's last name. Mm-hmm. I created my own middle name. As I knew a lot of, as a performer, I wanted my own identity. I wasn't very happy with the one that was foisted upon me. So I created my own. J was SJ because I'm Sarah Jane. I became Sarah J. Just a J in the 90s because that was all the rage. And then JAY extended from there. And Hawley was my mum's maiden name. Mm-hmm. So I took that on. Yeah.
Yeah, I have my mum's maiden name. My mum's maiden name as well. Rosenthal is my mum's.
Yeah, interesting that. I didn't know that that was a Viking thing. So it's there, you see.
I have a friend who was brought up in Bladen, which is west of Newcastle upon Tyne.
Right.
And that was an old Viking settlement. And there, within Bladen, he was known by his mother's surname.
Right.
When he went to school and then to university, he's known by his father's surname. That was, within that community, it was the matrilineal.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, my father was, we didn't know his surname. He was kind of, I've only just found out, on the run from some very shady past that he had. And so his name changed very often. And we had no, the bank was a box of money under the bed and there was no paper trail for us anywhere. And I didn't really know his lineage at all. And recently, there's been more, if they could fit more skeletons in the cupboard, some more have fallen out. My sisters just find a couple of other brothers that were hanging around, when I was a kid, that were not that much older than me, that we never knew about. So he had a secret family thing going on, and he died a long time ago. So he's always been quite a mystery to me. And it's, it's an interesting one, that. I'd yet to meet them, but let's see.
If you want to follow that up, Gemma and I know someone who's been on the podcast who can help you with that.
No, they're found. My sister's been in touch with them and had conversations. I just don't know, maybe. I'm a big maybe.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Did you find you had to do lots of research for your book around your family history and different things that happened, or are you just going off of what you know? Is it more?
Yeah, no, the book's written in first person present tense. So, up until the point recently where I found this stuff out and the different points where other secrets emerged and other people's versions of the truth, the truth and the lies that is in every family. It just is as it is. So there's no reflection as you move through the book. You find out these things as you're traveling with me on the journey. A friend read one of the early manuscripts and said, it's like you've just grabbed me by the hand and started running. But that's what my life feels like. And I said, I'm really glad you said that, because I've obviously written it so that you can feel like what my life is like, has been like.
Did you know, this is a random fact, but did you know Kate Bush's song Running Up the Hill is number one at the moment?
Yes, I did know that. Of course I knew that, Gemma. Oh my God.
Just when you said takes my hand and running, and I just had Running Up the Hill.
yeah. Kate Bush and me were very... She was the first album I ever bought was The Kick Inside by Kate Bush when I was about... I think I was in 11 when that came out. Wow. So, yeah, I've been a Kate Bush super fan forever. Absolutely forever. Mm-hmm. So I'm really thrilled that...
Yeah, it's really good.
Back in the ears of young folk who can hear, real stories.
Yeah.
Real stories in songs. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing. She's amazing.
And hills seem to be a theme, because she had the Vikings going from hill to hill.
And, there is a theme, actually. There's a really big hill theme in my book.
And also the jay, the bird called a jay, helps oak trees climb hills.
How does it do that? Oh my God, you're a mine of information, Chris. Yeah. Tell me about how jaybirds help oak trees climb hills, because that's just going to be in my book.
Well, acorns roll downhill. But jays bury acorns. And I think it's some phenomenal number, something like 5,000, they can bury something like 5,000 acorns a day. And then they forget where they buried them. So if they bury them on the side of a hill, then the oak tree will grow up the hill and it helps the trees.
I love it.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I am having that, seriously. There's a whole, there's a really big, they're all themes. Jays, birds, hills, songs, sea. They're all, you know, really fundamental keynotes in my life, all of those things. My saviours, really. And obviously songs.
And also apparently some sort of performance about Zen, drugs and rock and roll. So what was all that about? That's
what was all that about? Okay, that's quite a question. I had a stroke 6 years ago and was very, very, very brain damaged and couldn't really remember much about anything. And I found, but just to cut a long story short, I found myself through my songs. When I remembered, started to remember the songs that I'd written, when I sang the songs, I could remember where I was when I wrote them. So I started writing. I couldn't write either. I've got the occipital lobe damage, so reading was, for a couple of years, was impossible. Reading and writing, apparently, are two different parts of the brain, which I didn't know. So writing was a lot easier, but it was a bit Harry Potter because I couldn't see what I was writing. It was like only when my hand was at the other side of the page could I see a couple of words that I'd written. It took a long time and a very stubbornly, tenaciously, just cracked on with it. And the stories behind the songs, I just became a thing that I just got me out of bed in the morning because it was a very dark and depressing time, that I would write a story, why I wrote the song, because a confessional songwriter. I didn't realise how much my songs had been my therapy until I started this process of what is the story behind the song. And then after a few years, I've written hundreds of songs and I had quite a number of stories behind the songs, which were little blogs that I put on YouTube with versions of the songs, started to get a bit of traction, and then realized, and I've always known that my life story is epic and crazy and really dark as it is funny. You know, there's some real comic tragedy in it. And people have always said to me, no, when I say yes, and then no, and then, you know, so you've got to write a book. So here I am. It's become a book. I went to a sort of writing group to help me kind of piece it together. Beverly Ward, who's a local writer and mentor, is incredible. She does she does all sorts of things, but she really specializes in helping people write her. She wrote a grief memoir called Dear Blacksmith. And she really specializes in having a very open heart and allowing people to write within that kind of genre and in that space. So she helped me, and her lovely group just helped get it together. And then, you know, I thought, okay, well, I'm a singer songwriter, so some of the bits from the book became bits of prose that I put to music and the songs, and then got an Arts Council grant to get me back on the stage because I hadn't performed for 6 years, didn't know if I really wanted to. Not with my own music anyway. I've done a couple of little gigs with other bits of music. And it kind of went from there. Got a team of amazing women around me, musicians and engineers and producers and PAs, and just never worked only with women before. That was another something I fiercely wanted to do. Music business in the 80s and 90s was horrifically sexist. I've been assaulted God knows how many of times. You know, the kind of things that if somebody did that to my daughter, I would knock them out. And at the time, they do that to you and people laugh. Oh, it's just messing about. Oh, it's just, you know, actually, no, it's not okay. So there's a lot of that in my book, and it's thank God that people are talking more openly about that now. Mm-hmm. So I'm managing to be more honest and open about the impact of that abuse and assaults had on me. And I hadn't really realized either, because I took on everyone else's, oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, it's just, you know, and it's not. It really isn't. So a big part of me shut down and I hid away in rock and roll and drugs for a while. And this book is about trying to find, you know, the Zen, where I found the Zen in all of that. So, and it all spirals back around in on itself like a big murmuration, you know. Mm-hmm. Dissidents will always find harmony. Always. I've always been an optimist and had that faith because, as you know, music has been my parent, really.
So why do you think the Crucible sold out?
Well, it was just after lockdown. It was the first show that they'd put on. It was the Together season. So they had, you know, works in progress from different artists around the city. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, so I sent a pitch to them, and they were obviously like, yes, please, we'll have you. And yeah, I'm obviously a very well-known performer, and I have a good bunch of friends and fan base in Sheffield. And everybody came. Mm-hmm. And it sold out, and it was wonderful. Well, sold out for the Crucible during lockdown. You know,
that's amazing.
But it was just that post lockdown. It was people in masks sitting 5 seats apart, so it wasn't the full house, but it was as full as they could get it. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. It was incredible.
Yeah, it sounds great, and I'm fascinated by Zen coming before drugs and rock and roll, because it's usually a different word to that, and the reason I'm fascinated is my father was very into Zen himself, mm-hmm. and we had many conversations about Zen.
Right.
In fact, I was reading something about Zen last night, and the sort of highest point you can go beyond silence is laughter.
Lovely.
I was going to ask you, when did you last have a good laugh?
When did I last have this morning, talking to my friend on the phone? My friend who is in Hastings has got the dirtiest laugh. She laughs after every word, pretty much. She's hilarious, and she's just so contagious. And we have a laugh. We just have a laugh. And I like friends that I can be very funny. I've got a real comedian in me. My dad was a real comedian. It was his best armor, actually, while he was hiding from all of this bollocks that he'd strewn, this, you know, massive mess that he left behind him. Humor was his best cover. So, yeah, I picked that up from him. So, yeah, I love laughing, joking, laughing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Silence and laughter. Yeah, that's lovely to know that laughter's the next above silence. And the Zen thing is lovely, because my first kind of realization of that space between things was that music, I've read or heard somewhere, and it stayed with me and still is with me, that music is the space between the sounds. That is Zen. That is one of the most poignant Zen. As a teacher that music has been for me, it's that crosses everything. You can apply that to everything, to anything and everything.
Well, that's great. I'm very much looking forward to your story. Let's go straight into it.
Okay. This is an excerpt from my memoir, Zen, Drugs and Rock and Roll. And this is 1978. I'm bored of trying to overhear their conversations, bored of wanting to be older, bored of waiting to get out of here. I don't hide as often as I used to, and I spend more time practicing dangerous daredevil stunts on my purple rally chopper. Riding down steep steps and along high walls, I'm covered in bruises from ramps and jumps and thumps and playing chicken. I made myself some roller skates the other day from an old pair of monkey boots, scavenged the wheels, bolts and parts from a local jumble sale, and painted them purple to match my bike. They're now a permanent fixture on my feet. Marco, the local nightclub bouncer, and Sid have just moved into the room next door to Grandad's on the ground floor of our house. Sid's nearly 10, nearly the same age as me. I'm jealous of his posh colouring books and pencils, which he hates, because he's forced to do a page of colouring a day, and whenever his pencil goes over the line, Marco whips him with a kettle lead. I'm good at colouring, so I help him do it neatly. I've no idea where his mum is. Mario is very big and very hairy and very, very scary. Sid shows me the scarlet welts on his legs and winces when I touch them. I am so angry I can hardly breathe, and Sid tries to hold me back, but I have to tell someone, so I burst into Grandad's room. Domino, Grandad's dog, is standing on the bed. His ears prick up as I burst in. Grandad has his hands tight gripped on the Domino's back end. His tail is vertical. They're joined. We all freeze for a moment, a time standing still moment. I slam the door shut, leap down the stairs, 5 at a time, and find Mum and Auntie Kath busy being busy in the basement. Mum, Mum, did you know that Sid's dad's a bastard and Grandad's shagging his dog? Open. My eyes pop out of my head and my hands outstretched. They look at each other, then they look at me. Mum walks towards me slowly. I relax a little, expecting a hug, but get a clip round the ear instead. Don't be so bloody disgusting, Sarah. Auntie Kath turns her back on me, tips a cloud of white flour onto a wooden board, shaking her head, tutting loudly. But I'm not lying. Why would I lie about that? And what about Sid? We've got to do something for Sid. Have you seen the state of his legs? Mum? Go on, get out. Get outside and play, will you? Mum pushes me out of the kitchen. I dawdle back up the basement stairs in a daze, muttering to myself, what the hell is wrong with these people? Sid sitting on the floor with his head buried in his knees. He's been crying. Come on, Sid, let's go out and play. He follows me. He always does whatever I say, but it's getting really annoying. I know, Sid. Why don't we play cowboys and Indians? He nods. Okay, well, you can be the Indian. You sit in front of that tree and I'll tie you up. He obediently sits in front of the tree. I tie him up with some old washing line and I tie him up tight. He wriggles, but there's no way he's getting out of it. It suddenly comes from nowhere, the rage. It's rising in me. I yank off Stan's grubby plimsolls and start to hit him with them, gently at first and then harder and harder. His head buried in his hands, he cries out, stop, Sarah, stop it, please stop. I snap and snap out of it, drop his shoes and I run. Running through the wet grass in the park, across the gritty prom, and onto the soggy sandbank. I run out to the middle of the mud flats. The black, gooey oil slick sticks between my toes. I'll just stay here and wait for the tide to sweep in and take me. I might get lucky and get stranded on these mud flats and be rescued by the lifeboatmen just in time for tea. Red flares explode in the blue summer skies. Screeches from the wild mouse roller coaster ride. Squealing kids burying fat burnt bellies in the sand. Red bald heads on blue striped deck chairs lying in the sun. I'd better go home before the sea really does swallow me. I've been here for hours. And in sound. Sid's still sitting there, tied to the tree. Ray is kicking his heels, perched on a wall nearby. She looks too scared to release him. I might tie her up again too. We both torment him for a bit, then we let him go, give him his shoes back. He just sits there, doesn't move. Maybe he likes being tied up, says Ray as we walk away. It's my 11th birthday tomorrow and I'm not looking forward to it. I won't get what I really want. It's always a bit crap, a second-hand thing or even worse, an embarrassingly homemade thing. Saturday Night Fever's just come out. Sexy dancing, silky satin and disco balls. I'm in love with John Travolta, obviously. Steffi got me the big poster of the film from the cinema where she works as an usherette in the holidays. It takes centre stage on my bedroom wall. Whether you're a brother or whether you're a mother, you're staying alive, sing along to the soundtrack every day. And I want those red satin trousers for my 11th birthday and a thin red satin tie. And I'm very clear about this and pray to baby Jesus or whoever that they go to the shops or invest in the club book or steal them if they have to. But God, please, no, just not handmade. My birthday's in the winter when they're all skint. It's always a letdown. I know it's really stressful for Mum and I'm still the queen of bloody Sheba, according to Dad, and should just be bloody thankful. Well, Dad, if you didn't drink so much, I might get a nicer present, eh? Not that I dare say this out loud again. Thick ears come keen from him. I'm invited a couple of girls from school to a little tea party in Auntie's basement flat while my uncle's at work. It's much nicer than our flat, and she'll help with everything. My present's laid out on the table with the pink iced buns. Nervously, I peel back the Christmas tissue paper. There's a shimmer of shiny red. My eyes light up. I've got a golden ticket in my hand. I rip off the paper, I shake out the present, and then the tears prick my eyes as the lovingly handmade trousers appear. Go on then, love, try them on, says Mum, smiling. I reluctantly drag them on. The elasticated waist sends static flying and makes my long, straggly hair stand on end. There's a red satin tie too, a kipper tie. I feel like a shiny idiot tied in the middle. Thanks, Mum. Auntie has made me a cake in the shape of a swimming pool with sugar bathers doing breaststroke on blue marzipan. I hate marzipan. I leave the room clutching the big cake knife. I can't hold it in any longer. I'm going to cry. Auntie finds me stabbing holes in the innocent beanbag frog that sits on the back of her sofa. Hey, lovey, what's up? She eases the knife from my tight grip and whispers, come on, come on. She walks me outside. My head rests on her shoulder. I can't find any words. When we go back in, everything's cleared away and I'm relieved to see that the girls I invited have gone too. I plonk myself down on the pull-down bed in Auntie's living room. My uncle comes in, smelling of rum. He looks me up and down, leans in and whispers close to my face, "I'll have you in that bed in a minute, my girl." I run out of the house. Static sparks fly from my shiny red trousers, and I keep running. I just keep on running.
Wow. Had to give a little bit of a silence after that. It was really, really well written. And you felt like you were right there, like you were saying, you take us with you. And yeah, I wasn't expecting as well to be you at 11 as well. It was an interesting choice of age to bring us to, but it was really nice to have that insight of you at that age and what was going on around you and all the different emotions, and it's really raw.
Thanks, Gemma. It's a lot of it is still quite raw. And I think I chose that because maybe I'm editing this book at the moment, and that was one of where I was at in the edit. So it felt really quite alive for me, like I said. Otherwise, there's 50-odd chapters in this book because each one's like a year. I'm 54. My memories start when I'm 3 or 4. So it's a timeline of a series of amazingly brilliant and some unfortunate events, let's say. And, you know,
how
it's eventful.
Like, how do you remember so much detail?
I have ADHD, so I realised when I'm writing, I've avoided a lot of these memories because a lot of them are really painful, and it's been a really amazingly cathartic process that has cost a fortune in therapy as I've gone through it. And I hit a lot of walls emotionally and then had to give it up and get some help, some therapeutic help to get me through that particular chapter as the realisation dawned, oh my God, I'm fucking stuck. I'm frozen. The emotions that are coming with this, I never knew. It was like an unleashing of feelings that had been prehistoric dinosaur blocked in ice, kind of grow, you know, melting. The freeze around trauma really is what was melted with the process of writing this book. So, and it's one of the reasons I realised why I'm such a good performer, because when I'm present, I am very, very present. And when I'm not, I'm everywhere. So, you know, that's an ADHD thing. And it is, you know, this cliche at the moment that's around, it is a superpower, but it's also fucking hard work to be that person in life with typicals or muggles. Maybe that's what the muggles means. That would be so disrespectful if you are one of those special people, you know, kind of how hiding and masking all of that trauma and the fallout of that kind of childhood manifested in later life has been interesting. But now I've reached a point where I can talk about it. I can, you know, there was a lot more abuse went on, and I talk about that very openly in the book. Again, lots of money spent on deep therapy and has brought me to a place where I feel more whole and connected to myself than I ever have, really. So I'm just, you know, writing as catharsis. I thought songwriting was, that's always been catharsis for me, but actually writing this memoir, uncovered memories, you know, it's like digging for treasure, but finding some dark bones in there as well. That was like, shit, I didn't really want that memory, but here it is. So better have a look at it, because I don't want to keep running.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved your use of detail and the sense of place as well, particularly when you ran out from you tied Sid to the tree and then ran out, and suddenly we were in Skegness, and there was a world sort of opened up and then closed down again, and also that your story is populated by loads of other people.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things is that one of the keys to writing a compelling life story is being able to express your inner experience through the outer experience.
Yeah. Interesting. And show, don't tell. That was the other thing, is that, which is just so it's as if somebody else, I've got a brilliant editor working on it, and she said, you know, it's like a filmmaker. She said it was like watching a grainy 70s film, reading some of the earlier stuff, like a filmmaker had. I'm really hoping to get this sold, you know, Shameless by the Sea to Netflix once this is written, but a musical, you know, kind of, because there's so many songs associated with the whole journey, or a musical version of this story, because it's, for want of a less naff word, it's all very zeitgeist now. And I'm of that age where I've lived through four decades of music. You know, I've been performing since I was 14, and 4 decades of music as a performer is quite something. You know, I'm in that. My friend this morning referred to me, oh God, you're like a Northern Anna Madrigal, which is, you know, the woman from Tales of the City, Armistead Maupin. It was like, yeah, okay, I'll have that. I will have that, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I'm really excited and obsessed at the moment, and I've just got enough Arts Council funding to allow me 3 months of just head down and focusing on this, which is just a godsend. An absolute godsend. But thank you for your wonderful reactions, because nobody's really heard this. First time I've read a full chapter to anyone. I was nervous doing it, more nervous than singing on a stage in front of millions of people, you know, talking to you two. Just this, it's a deep share. So thank you. Really, you know.
It's something about, I mean, some of the things you mentioned are things that people might be ashamed of, but there's something about the way in which you write it that you know, you're inviting us in to a dark place, but somehow I can't find the words. somehow you illuminate it. I felt safe with you.
That's amazing. Oh my God! That's amazing, Chris. Thank you.
Does that work for you, Gemma?
It's like you're exploring the shadow side within this story of the people around you, of yourself, of everything in the story. And I think when you can go to that place and not be ashamed of it, and just say this is what it was, there's something completely freeing for the audience or the listener or the reader, because they probably have those places as well, which they wouldn't feel brave enough to share necessarily. Yeah. Most people wouldn't. So when you share it, you're freeing the listener to go, wow, oh, wow, yeah, I can relate to that. It may not be the same, well, it won't be the same situation. Yeah. That no one has your experience, but everyone has the experience of those darker places where it's uncomfortable. But if you can write it in a comfortable, uncomfortable way, so you've got that dynamic of making the reader feel comfortable, but there's uncomfortable stuff.
Get it. That's really, you're both saying some amazing things. It's really wonderful. And being comfortable with uncomfortable feelings is really the story of my life. I mean, that's what a performer does. That's how you become a professional performer, is you get comfortable with uncomfortable feelings. But I came, you know, I got kind of comfortable with those feelings from a very young age, or found a place for them to hide. And it was mostly in nature. Mm. Kind of nature helped wash them away, that real polarity of the darkness and the light. And you know, like you saying, kind of the very small microcosm that we all have within a tight family unit, whatever, however it is, and then the bigger world. It's interesting.
You've reminded me of a very, very short story that I read last night. And it's the story of, I think it was a rabbi who went into a restaurant and sat down and had a cup of coffee. He couldn't have any more than a coffee because it was a holy day and it was a fast day. And as he was finishing his coffee, he looked across the room at another table. There was one of his congregation tucking into a steak. So he went across and he said, you do know this is a holy day and we should be fasting. And the young man says, yes, I do know. Yes, I very definitely do know that. And he says, so are you ill? Has the doctor allowed you to... abstain from fasting? He says, no, I'm in perfect health. And the rabbi was really pleased with him because he wasn't lying about his sinning. And there's something, you know, because when you think in the story, you know, the way you tied Sid up and then hit him with the shoes, you know, it's a bad thing, but it's also it's almost humorous. I had such a mix of emotions at that point. You were doing something wrong, and yet, you know, but there's something about just being able to be open about that. And it's not just that people around you were doing bad things. You were one of those people.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important. You're a part of it. And it's not about judging whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. It's, but there's something very real about it.
I think, especially as kids, we just respond to what's around us, you know, and the kind of emotions I was dealing with, especially that day, were really hard. You know, I had just seen my granddad shagging his dog when I'd burst into the room to tell him that the neighbours, his kid was being beaten to shit by this bouncer that lived up the road. You know, it was like, that's not an easy thing for an 11-year-old to, and it was just, that's my childhood. It was one thing after another, relentless, weird shit going on, and magic realism, but in this dark Skegness kind of place. And I think it would make the better. I can't wait. The pitch to HBO is going to be phenomenal. I can't wait to get that.
Dark Skegness.
Well, it's going to, I don't know. They're not going to have heard of Skegness, are they? But who knows?
Oh, it's so bracing.
Certainly is. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
But what you need, perhaps, in a situation like that is hope. And Gemma.
Oh, God, yeah.
Gemma has a lot to say about hope.
It's not so much what I'm saying about hope, although I will talk about it after. But basically, I'm reading this book at the moment called When Things Fall Apart, Heart Advice for Difficult Times by Pema Chodron. Who I think is a Buddhist monk. And I came across this section yesterday and I was talking to Chris about it, and he suggested that it might be a good thing to share on the podcast, because it made me question the word hope, because she uses it as a bad thing, as in that we should give up hope. So I'll just read the section that it makes a bit more sense. Hopelessness is the basic ground. Otherwise, we're going to make the journey with hope of getting security. If we make the journey to get security, we're completely missing the point. We can do our meditation practice with the hope of getting security. We can study the teachings with the hope of getting security. We can follow all the guidelines and instructions with the hope of getting security, but it would only lead to disappointment and pain. We could save ourselves a lot of time by taking this message very seriously right now. Begin the journey without hope of getting ground under your feet. Begin with hopelessness.
Interesting.
And when I read this yesterday, I had some feelings, because I was thinking, no, I need hope. I need to hope that things can get better, that there's life to be had, that there's something I can grasp within this world. And yet I also knew the truth of what she was saying, is that there is no life other than here and now. And you can't, the more you hope for something better than what you are, the less you can actually accept the moment. So I think this is what she's talking about. And anyway, we had a conversation with Chris, and Chris has a really nice way of describing hope in a different way. I don't know if you want to express that, Chris, just to explain.
Well, the part of the body that embodies hope, perhaps, and it's not just me who thinks that, this is the feet. Hope is where your feet are. And so I don't think of hope as something in the future. I think of hope as being something in the here and the moment, and as I say, where your feet are. And because where your head and your heart are where your feet are, you know, because it's your feet that takes them there. And we can go off into all sorts of fantasies and so on, but ultimately we're brought back onto the ground. And indeed, you know, we saw that in Sarah's story, where you know it was very much rooted in a particular place, and as a child, you're committed to the place where you're told you're committed to. As an adult, you can to some degree choose where you're going to be. But ultimately, it's your commitment. And it's your commitment to that place and to that community and to that life that actually makes hope real. Because it's, you know, we're all in this together. If you like. Does that make sense?
Yeah. On another note, Hope, I was the I did some charity work for the Stroke Association last year and was the hope of the face of hope after stroke for the Stroke Association. So there's something about, I know exactly what you mean, Gemma. The only place to be and to be for to come from is exactly where you are. The more present you can be, I mean, that's Zen, isn't it? That's the Zen of being.
Oh, yes, I'm sure.
So that there's no hope in Zen, it just is.
Yeah.
So I get that. And from that place of hopelessness, you know, hope springs eternal, like all the other wonderful works of art that have come from hope. So, however, had I not had people around me that were further down the line from me, further into their recovery process after having had a stroke, they gave me hope, because if I hadn't had people further down the line saying it gets better, you just have to have faith and hope and believe that this will not be like this forever, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, so hope was an essential part of my recovery, really.
But you don't know where you're going till you get there, in a way.
Absolutely, I had no idea that the process of writing this book would unleash all of those demons and bring me to this much more whole place. You know, there was something in me that wanted to look them in the eye and lay them to rest so that I could come into the second act of life. My daughter's left home. You know, I feel like, you know, traveling, touring the world those days. It's a very much a young woman's game, that. It's bloody knackering. I have no interest in hurtling around the world performing every night, as wonderful as it was. Now and again, but not, you know, in the same way. So there is the second act, I believe, a lot of women of my age are calling post, you know, menopausal, kids left home, this massive empty space around, you know, it's kind of
what to do with
it.
We actually interviewed, was it Jaswinda, who we had on the podcast? Jazz. And she shared her bit of her story that's in the book that I'm in, The New Woman. Mm-hmm. And it was specifically about when her son left and how that affected her as a mother and how her whole identity shifts.
Yeah.
And just how, you know, it's not really talked about.
No.
You just sort of expected to carry on. And
I know, it's very bizarre. This empty nest thing, until you're in it, it's more, it's like a weird void. It's an odd psychological emptiness. It's not just a loneliness. It's almost like a purpose, almost like a primal purpose that has been removed in this phase of womanhood. And I'm sure there's gold on the other side. You know, I have every intention of being the most amazing person, you know, that woman. The menopause is, again, an interesting process that women in my family all died before they got there. I've had quite a difficult time with loss in my life. So I've not had I've not seen anyone else go through it, really. And so I haven't watched or witnessed or been part of the mirror that other people are. So, yeah, some good friends are sharing their experiences of it. But, you know, it's still only just in this day and age, Christ, something that people are talking about more openly and taking more seriously. Well, when I say people, I mean women, even allowing themselves to talk about it more openly with each other, because most men I know, and most of the men I know, are more evolved than most men, still don't know how to engage in that conversation, or, you know, that it's not, I don't know. It's another brand new thing. It's like, oh, great. And I like brand new things, but this one.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's a tricky one.
I'm sure it is. And it's something, there's something in the way that the natural world operates. You can never go back to how things were. So when there's environmental damage, for example,
are you likening the menopause to environmental damage there,
well,
Chris?
Well, I'm not quite sure that I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this. So, the point I was going to make is you can't go back to how things were before. However, new species come in, and things develop and change, and you can have a new environment that's maybe just as good as the one that was before.
Absolutely, yeah. That's
how, and I think part of the problem, and it's partly to do with aging. That's part of it, and men do share that bit of it.
Yeah.
At any rate, dropping the expectations that you had when you were younger, but taking up new expectations. And it's actually pretty good being old. If you're in good health, at any rate. And I can't speak for everyone, obviously, but it's okay.
How old are you, Chris? Sarah asked.
Sorry? How old am I?
How old are you?
I'm 67. So I think that counts as getting on a bit.
I think it's, I mean, I hope this comes out in the right way. I really admire having older people around me, because I feel like as a young person, you can learn so much from what someone else has lived. Mm-hmm. That you just can't necessarily learn from your peers, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, I was reading about Gabor Mate, who's a trauma, used to be a doctor. And he actually talks about ADHD a lot, because mm-hmm. he has it as well. And he says about how one of the reasons why young people are suffering is because they haven't got that older generation support of where they feel comfortable to talk to them, to learn from them. And then they're learning from their peers who don't have a clue what's going on, and they're all just trying stuff out. And that's why you end up with, you know, the drugs and everything. And just, whereas when you can actually speak to the older generation as an equal, rather than, but also as someone who has gone through as an elder as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You can actually then learn through, I don't know if it's called, it's not osmosis, is it? I don't know. You learn through someone else's experiences, so you don't have to necessarily go through such a hard time as they did.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a hard time, but you just learn. And Chris gives me so much wisdom every time we're on a chat, like even just to discuss the podcast. Chris will give these little nuggets of things which I write down, And, you know, the thing about the feet and hope, he actually talked about, is it the quote from the Bible as something like your hands?
That's Julian of Norwich, I think.
Oh, is it? It's not from the Bible.
Let's see if I can remember it. Christ has no body now on earth but yours, no hands but yours, no feet but yours. Yours are the eyes through which Christ's compassion cares for the peoples of this world. Yours are the feet for which Christ is to go about doing good. Yours are the hands through which Christ now brings a blessing.
Yeah, I love
and
that.
And of course, Julian of Norwich was an anchoress, which meant that she didn't go about. She was bricked into a small room in a church. And she had a window to pass food and the potty through, and another window where she could see the altar where they celebrated communion. And that's all she could see. And she created some of the, she wrote some of the most valuable English mystical writing.
What's her name again, Chris?
Julian of Norwich.
Julian?
Julian, yes.
So a man, a woman?
No, so a woman. Yeah, a woman called Julian. Yeah.
Julian of Norwich. Wow. Okay. I've never heard of her. I will look into her.
And she wrote that quote?
Yes, I think that was
her.
Wow. Well, if it wasn't her, it was another mystic. It was definitely a woman.
I love that it's a woman. We don't normally hear a lot of quotes
There are many,
Well, we do, as in not written down, I mean.
There are many women mystics who did write over the centuries. It's an occupation that women seem to take to equally with men.
Definitely, yeah. It's good to show that it is as well, and not to erase that part of history, as a lot of the time we get all these male mystics and saints, and then we forget that there's also women there.
Have either of you read Sandy Toksvig's Almanac?
No, I Sandy wouldn't know Toksvig. How to write that.
Toksvig, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. The greatest Doctor Who we've never had.
Yes, actually, wouldn't she be a great Doctor Who? Oh yes.
I think we should have a campaign at some point.
She was speaking and she did a gig in Sheffield, I didn't know about it. Some friends of mine went, it was sold out, otherwise I would have gone. But yes, Sarah Almanac, Gemma, is women who have done amazing things for the last few centuries that have never received the credit that they deserved or the recognition or acknowledgement. So it's like an almanac of things that happened over the last few hundred years.
Can you send me a link?
Well, if you send it to me as well, I can put it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
And have a look at it as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, shall we move on? I just wanted to finish with a little thought experiment. And what this is about, it's the find in Find, Tell, Share. And one of the challenges that we have is finding stories. Sarah J's got loads of stories which are all going into a book, so maybe it's not so much a problem for you. That's one of the challenges of storytelling is just finding stories, and there are various techniques that you can use to find new stories from life experience and anywhere else you can dig them out. And the method I just want to talk about is the prompt. And the idea of a prompt is that a prompt might be a dog. Sorry, I thought about this before I heard your story. Not that dog. Well, not necessarily that dog.
A story then.
But the point is that the story that you tell might not feature a dog in it at all. It's been prompted by the idea of a dog. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the point of a prompt is not a chain or a lock that's holding you down. It's more like a key that unlocks ideas and creativity.
I think my mind just works in musical ways, and I just got, who let the dogs out?
Well, there's a song for everything.
There
is. What I wanted to do, this is a challenge for both of you, and Sarah, you'll be going first, unless you really complain, is I'm going to give you three different prompts. And the situation is that you've been asked to write a song using one of those prompts. Now, I'm not asking you to write the song, not unless you suddenly get a massive inspiration.
Well, no doubt that will happen, Chris.
but really, just to choose one of the three prompts and say why you've chosen it, and hopefully we'll begin to see how prompts work. So you might want to jot these down if you're bad at remembering. So these are the three prompts that you have to choose from.
Are they long?
One of them's longer than the other two.
I don't have a pen, so just
The longest one is a lost village, town, or city. That's the first prompt. Second prompt is an ancient woodland. And the third prompt is a hot beverage. So the question is, if you were going to write a song, which of those prompts would you choose and why?
The middle one, I think.
Ancient woodland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why is that?
Because it's just metaphorical. You could go anywhere into the woods. You know, it's there's lots in it. There's lots of dimensions, lots of visual inspirations, lots of light, lots of dappled light to play with. And I write a lot about woodlands. I live just right across the road from Aincliffe Park, which is one of the oldest woodlands in the country. It used to be Sherwood Forest, didn't it, this end of Sheffield?
Oh, right.
Anyway, so yes, that would be mine.
Yes. Yes, that was one of the reasons I chose that. I wanted something that opened up. Going into the woodlands can close the things as well.
It
can get lost and feel very constrained, but it can also open things up. But there's also relationships within the woodland, and we're finding more and more about how particularly the plants and the trees are connected by fungus underground and so on.
Yeah. There's a really nice, it just brings me a memory of when I went to San Francisco, did some gigs there, and I went to the ancient Mir woods with the redwood forests.
Oh, yes.
So, it would never leave me, that experience. And really metaphorically for me, coming from such an unanchored and ungrounded life, trees are just, for me, saviours and always have been. You know, climbing them, hiding in them, hugging them, carving my name into them, sitting under them, all kinds of things around them. They've just been, you know, and the Ents in Lord of the Rings, I just think are fantastic. There's a fantastic aliveness to their ancient wisdom and interconnectivity, like you've said.
And you see what's happening now as you speak, you're seeing more and more connections.
Yeah.
And that's the power of the prompt, just to uncover something creative, or something that you can use. So, yeah. Gemma, which of them would you choose?
Well, I would actually choose the same one, because immediately my mind went to fairies, and. Me and my sister and my cousins actually, we'd find a tree and then decorate and say like that the fairies were going to come along if we decorated the tree. It was something we did as kids. And I don't know. There's something that just came up visually for me. I don't know where I'd go with a song for it. But maybe something around Fairy in the Woods or something sparkly and magical. Maybe some bells, kind of tinkly sounds, but then also like some deeper, like synth sounds, I don't know, sonically, and some harmonies. And maybe you could do like a poetry or spoken word in there. And then also it reminded me of a song that I have called Learning to Fly, which is so weird because I was going through the lyrics and I was thinking there is no woods in these lyrics, but for some reason every time I sing it I picture woods, that I'm in the woods, because the story is someone who's learning to fly, isn't it? Goes into the sky, so later on in the song you're in the sky and you're flying, but at the beginning it's like that you're running and getting ready to take off. And for some reason, even though the lyrics say about parks, running past the parts in the depths of the creation, all that I've known is no longer anymore, my hand reached out the air and my feet are off the floor and I saw, it's like for some reason I imagine myself in a woods like every time I sing it. And I'm just like, maybe it's the lyric of depths of the creation or something, I don't know, but like I just realized, I was like, there is no woods in these lyrics, but for some reason that's how I picture it in my mind. So it's really weird how some songs can not even speak the actual vision that you, I don't know if you have this, Sarah, you know, when you write a song, do you have like a visual that comes with it, or does that come later when you're like creating a video?
No, it's all feeling. I'm not really a visually led person, actually. I'm much more feeling based, kinesthetic led person. And also, it's none of my business what other people think of my songs or where they are when they hear them. And the best songs, everyone's somewhere else.
Yeah.
No, not any, you know, not, no, unless it's obviously really obvious, implicit in the song. But I think the best songs are universal and people can place themselves anywhere.
That's
visually,
true.
Visually, or within an environment that you know is theirs.
I did think about fairies or folks or trolls or whatever when I chose that image as well, because there was a local authority somewhere that had to put its foot down because the fairies started putting little doors at the bottom of trees. And soon almost every tree in this wood had got a little door on it. And in the end, they had to stop them from doing that. And but there's something about when you're walking through a woodland, there's things going on in the corner of your eye. And it can be both real and unreal. One of the songs that came to my mind when I was planning this is by Engelbert Humperdinck, but not that one, the other one. he wrote an opera called Hansel and Gretel for children, and it's very short, so don't panic. The song goes, tell me if you can, what's the name of this old man with a purple cloak and a small black hood? And we learned that at school many, many years ago. And I think it's Gretel sings it to Hansel when they're trying to sleep out in the forest. But the little man is a toadstool with a purple cloak and a black hood. So you've got both the as it were, real toadstool, but also somehow it's personified. And I think there's, we've perhaps lost that sense of the enchantment of the natural world.
You speak for yourself, Chris.
I'm speaking generally. The we was a very, very general we. But no, say more. So speak for yourself.
I just think, you know, I don't know. I just thought that was it. I don't think, depends what company you keep, doesn't it really? I mean, I had a great experience the other day walking through my local park and Hunters Bar kids were out full on protest banners, megaphones, pictures that they'd drawn, you know, save our planet. Just really, and they're supported by their fabulous teachers, obviously, but it looked like the whole school was out doing a protest march and circling trees. And I just stopped and cried. It's just, you know, it was a glorious thing. I'm going to cry now just thinking about it. So I do think there is, and they really meant it. You know, it wasn't, didn't look like it was something they'd been forced to do, or, you know, and the way that they were being obviously guided and engaged and had created these beautiful drawings of birds and mushrooms and trees and that they were carrying around with them, that had been a fully engaged project was, just incredible. It was incredible to see. So,
well, that's my old school, and we used to go to Aincliffe Park with the school for the sports day. We had sports days, but also turning stones over in the Porter Brook and finding strange creatures underneath them.
Yeah.
I don't remember us ever doing a protest. That's new.
It was great.
Okay, so I think we're wrapping up the podcast now, and so if we will play one of Sarah's songs to finish, and if Sarah, if anyone wants to, well, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute joy to hear you tell your story, and there's been dark moments, there's been intimate moments, and just you've really grasped our attention and, you know, just shared everything, and it's just great to have such honesty on the podcast. It's really, really nice, so thank you. And how can our listeners find you on the socials?
Sarah J. Hawley. If you Google Sarah J. Hawley, somehow I'm top of the search engine, so everything Sarah J. Hawley will arrive. So I have a website and social media, and I am resisting putting any of my new music or any of the Zen project up there for the moment, because I would like it all to fly out at the same time with some proper support, and when I start touring and releasing the book next year. So there'll be little teasers from little tiny workshoppy moments that I do, but nothing of any real substance around that until next year. So I'm really excited about that. And meanwhile, I'm just hanging back off social media, really. I'm just so immersed in actually what I'm doing that social media has become uninteresting.
Less
important, to be honest. I'd rather go and talk to the fairies in the park with my new little dog.
Wouldn't we all?
Well, this is new, to have a guest that's telling you to go and listen to the fairies instead of go on social media. So
they'll tell you what I'm doing.
If you want to. But if you do want to listen to Sarah's music, she has loads on YouTube.
Thanks, Gemma.
And you can find find her on social media. She has lots for you to listen to in the meantime.
Yeah.
And you can obviously go in the park and listen to the fairies as well. I just banged my knee. Chris, how do we find you?
Usual place. It'll all be in the show notes. My newest thing, I've been publishing blog posts on Seventh Wave, and I think I've put a link in the show notes for that, but I'll make sure that that it's there. And and as always, I'm always looking for storytellers for Thursday afternoons, which are restarting in September. And if local people, Sarah, would like to have a go at that, we could even do it as a lunch and learn and come off Zoom and have a go at real life storytelling again.
It's really nice, the storytelling sessions that Chris does, because it gives you a supportive environment to just share your story and just get a bit of feedback from local people, or if it's online, obviously anyone. I've met some of my closest friends on the storytelling groups, Manifestation Maven, who we also interviewed. I met her for the first time and we've done loads of work together. So it's really good for networking as well. So you can find me on Gemma Rosenthal. I'm on pretty much all the sites. You can possibly find YouTube, Facebook, Spotify, all the music sites, all the social medias, Instagram. I'm also on as creativehearts.coach, which is my coaching, which has more to do with the coaching side, and cards as well. We're selling creative cards at the moment. Me and BT Design have designed some cards to help your creativity and self-love. And Chris mentioned Seventh Wave. I've also got a blog on Seventh Wave, which I share some blog posts. So that's me, and thank you to Chris. Thank you, Sarah.
Pleasure.
I think we're done.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye, guys. Thanks for having me. It's been brilliant. Tomorrow, it should have been yesterday.
tell